Hello and welcome back to a new series of Theatre Voice, the Victoria and Albert Museum's performance podcast. The actor Lucy Ellinson is a bit of a cult favourite, the performer's performer, perhaps. Over the last decade, she's moved from tiny, offbeat fringe spaces to some of the biggest stages in Britain. The Olivier for Lindsay Turner's revival of Top Girls, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre to play Puck, and right now she's starring as Macbeth at the Manchester Royal Exchange. When I started writing about theatre about a decade ago, Lucy was one of the most vivid presences on any stage I came across. I still remember her weighed down by white chairs in Third Angel's Presumption, or hunting vampires around the Barbican's underground car park for Slung Low. I remember her practically tearing herself apart in Dee Lohar's monologue Land Without Words at the Edinburgh Festival, playing an artist paralysed by having witnessed a war zone. For me, almost a decade on, that project still encapsulates Lucy's entire body of work. Somehow, she threads herself through every single part she plays, and it's rare for an actor this, but her politics determine every single job that she accepts. That might be George Brandt's explosive anti-drone monologue Grounded. It might be a Trumpian update of Brecht's Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy at the Donmar Warehouse, or the Carnival of Queer that was Derek Jarman's Jubilee, also for the Manchester Royal Exchange. As you'll soon hear, her Macbeth there means much, much more of the same.
Studying at Leeds University, I think it was 97 that I went. I certainly graduated in 99 because it was the year of the millennium, and that was very exciting for everybody. It was an English Literature and Theatre Studies course, which is still running now. Not a course that was driving you towards a career as an actor particularly, but gave you the opportunity to make a lot of performance whilst being an undergraduate. So we had a workshop theatre, which is celebrating an anniversary this year, in fact, and we were able to use that facility to put on plays that we were inspired by or making ourselves. And we had, what was particularly notable for me was the international MA programme that was running at the same time as our undergraduate course, because those practitioners came from all around the world. There were people from Eritrea, Japan, America, Uganda, producing work based on their own specific creative practice and cultural practice, and I got to volunteer to audition for parts in those plays. Prior to that, I'd been involved in a youth theatre at Theatre Clwyd in Mould, but hadn't very much experience and certainly very little confidence in terms of being a performer. And in that 3 years, I sort of see that really now as my unofficial training, and being exposed to different ideas about what theatre is and can be, how you go about making it and why you're making it, for whom you're making it. Those questions were really integral for those artists, and they really sort of exposed me to a lot of new ideas that I'd never been exposed to before, looking at theatre as a tool to speak politically, but also form, how that might speak politically. And it was a brilliant time. You know, I got to do all sorts of plays, make all sorts of mistakes, and really, yeah, sort of broaden my horizons. At that time as well, there were a number of friends who are people that I've become regular collaborators with and are now writing and making theatre, shaping other people's work. So Wendy Hubbard and Yael Shavit, who directors and dramaturgs I've worked with for many years, Chris Thorpe, who I got to know on the course and has been a very dear friend since, John Donnelly, Dan Bai, all people who I've really come to love and admire as theatre artists, but really lean on as a person as I'm navigating my own way through theatre world as well. So I don't think any of us knew at the time that we were going to go on and do this forever. Maybe they did, I don't know, but we certainly developed close friendships, and I think that sense of leaning on one another and being part of the community has been influential to us individually and collectively since.
at what point did it become clear to you that this is something that you would go on to do forever, as you just put it?
I don't know, and I still don't know if it is for me, really. I'm not sure. Sometimes I ask myself the question, is it the most useful thing you can do with your time on Earth? And I'm not quite sure if it is for me, and there are plenty of people who are better at it than me, so I ask myself that question regularly, if I'm totally honest. I didn't know when I came out of university still that it was something I could do. I felt low on confidence, and I definitely felt that the world of casting as a female actor was a little hostile. I couldn't see where the roles were that were fulfilling, or that had much agency or said the things that I wanted to say. So I floated around odd jobs and became quite politically active at that time. I was part of the Stop the War Coalition. And once George Bush and Tony Blair's sort of warmongering was apparent, that felt to me a more important place to put my energy than a theatre career. But it was interesting, during that time in that campaign, I met a really many brilliant people, but one in particular called Mike Marcosi, who is sadly no longer with us, but became a real mentor for me. He was someone who'd combined a career of political activism within the Labour Party and outside of the Labour movement too. He was a poet, an absolute cricket diehard, and he wrote poetry, wrote books about politics and sport, as I say, was an activist, and he encouraged me during that time, those 2 years I worked for the Stop the War Coalition, to allow myself to think about also being an artist as well. I wasn't necessarily doing a bad thing by allowing myself to follow that interest, and he encouraged me to say yes to a job that I'd been considering, which was working with a company in Leeds called Theatre Company Blah Blah Blah, and they were touring a piece of work, and I joined them, took some time out from the campaign and joined them to take a piece of work around Leeds and a bit further out, and that work was largely involved with young people in pupil referral units, and young people in prison, and another company based in Shipley as well called Shoestring. I started working with them, and I did about 2 years on and off of touring with young people and adults in those contexts, which was a really important part of my experience as a young actor, seeing what theatre could do for people, particularly people who are incarcerated, who don't get much access to culture, and that part of themselves. We'd perform the play and we'd do a workshop afterwards, and you'd have men in these Category B prisons coming up to you saying, miss, you know, please come back and do a Shakespeare. Because their chance to actually express themselves was so little. That was a real privilege to do that, and yeah, wherever they are, I hope they're doing okay.
And from that point onwards, how have you found ways in which to express your politics through your art, through your performances, through your theatre work?
I think it's a joint effort, really. I think I've been very blessed to meet other artists and retain those relationships. Artists that really care about the questions of who gets to see the work and who gets to make the work. So Unlimited Theatre were a company that developed me very much as a younger artist, Third Angel too. And they're companies that are still going now that still care very much about those questions. Slung Low Theatre was we didn't know who we were at that point, but we were a collective of artists. They hosted a group of emerging artists, and we met regularly at the Theatre in the Mill in Bradford and made work with the intention of taking it out of theatre buildings, really, and putting it in spaces where people could encounter it as they do their shop or as they meet their friends. And interestingly, that question for me has changed a little bit over the years, in that all the outdoor performance and cabaret and sort of politically engaged street theatre that I was doing that I felt really passionate about, and theatre in not theatre buildings. I really felt strongly, you know, get out of the theatres and make theatre in communities. And I still feel that urgency, but I'd also feel that theatre's opening their doors to allow that community to be inside, to use those facilities, to blend a mixture of having experience of culture with childcare or access to computers or cheap food. You know, those things are really important for theatre buildings to take responsibility for, and I think many do, and I really congratulate those that do in this country. So I've gone full circle around where the theatre can take place, but the question of the form in which it takes and who you're really mindful of throughout your process of making is still a great concern in my mind. Yeah.
And as an actor, does your politics inform the kinds of roles that you would choose to take on and how you approach those roles as well?
I think so. I mean, I think often the idea of choosing isn't something you get to think about so much as an actor. Often you, because you're sort of in this quite precarious situation, the idea that you would say no to anything is quite a novelty. And I've had friends remind me that I can make choices over the years, which I'm really grateful for. I do feel concerned about the depiction of women on stage, and often I think women are used as violence against women is used as a way of intensifying drama, and that's something I've always wanted to keep away from. Instances where that happen, even with the best intentions, actually, I think often makers and writers can make a decision to show this oppression in order to highlight wrongdoing and the problems of patriarchy, but in recreating those oppressions, I think sometimes it can create an abusive environment for audience members. You know, we know what it's like to be subjected to that abuse and to have to live through it again on stage is a question that people need to consider as artists, I think. So I've always had that concern. Recently, I've been working the past few years with the Deaf and Hearing Ensemble, and really being taken through a process of understanding how theatre as an art form is a hearing, this is in the words of my deaf colleague, a hearing person's art form, and wanting to very much to not allow that to happen in my work anymore. So trying to bring in those artists and experts to open up what access can be in terms of deaf and hard of hearing audiences. I think a concern I have now, particularly actually looking at this production now, is sort of because the theme of masculinity is so strong in the piece. It's what Shakespeare wrote about. You know, we call it toxic masculinity now, and that phrase wasn't available to him. And I'm not exactly sure whether he would have even seen it like that, given his depiction of relationships and gender in many of his plays. But the idea of manning up, not showing your emotions, of strongest man wins, and this performance of masculinity is really there in the heart of every moment of Macbeth. And we've wanted to meet that fully, not to modify it at all. We wanted to really greet it and embrace it. And for example, some of the language inside the play, Lady Macbeth challenges Macbeth frequently about being a man, and we didn't want to change that. Sometimes in the rehearsal room, people said, it's a bit jarring hearing this language. I said, well, you know, it sounds absurd because it is absurd. it is absurd to say, be a man, because what's that? That's increasingly becoming a meaningless phrase. Although I say that, and it's very meaningful because it's both absurd and deeply dangerous still, particularly for people who are trans and non-binary. So I've been interested in looking at, for example, stage patterns. So rather than having, you know, Macbeth in a central space with Lady Macbeth in and around Macbeth, that Oni and I share the space more. Macbeth writes to Lady Macbeth and says, you're, you know, a partner of greatness, and I've been holding on to that really keenly, so that this is a partnership you see on stage. You don't see a male protagonist with a woman serving that person's power, but you see a partnership. So it's little subtle things like that, which I hope the audience can feel and appreciate, but certainly mean a lot to me anyway, and how I approach it.
Yeah, it's certainly quite striking when watching it, when you hear the moments where those male pronouns haven't been changed, because Macbeth, as played by you, is very clearly a woman, yet there are all of these references throughout to masculinity.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that was making more of a gesture than simply switching the, you know, gender switched casting.
Yeah.
There can sometimes be a feeling that by simply changing the casting, that in itself is a political gesture. But it seems as though this production is trying to interrogate the play a bit further, go beyond the simply changing the gender of Macbeth and some of the other roles.
Yeah, I mean, I feel it really strongly that, and we might not have it completely right, you know, but I've been trying to sort of hold fast to the idea, or stick my courage to the sticking place, to the idea that we need to take the risk with that language and allow, you know, if it does go thud and an audience go, that's not quite right, hearing this person say this to this person, that we dare to take that chance. The idea of taking out these ideas and these languages and these belief systems felt wrong to me. There is a little journey of pronouns inside the piece which I feel, which feel very beautiful to me, which is we begin, you know, obviously we've changed the pronouns for Queen Duncan and Macbeth in order for us to be clear about who we're talking about, particularly with a female-female relationship. There is a line that, oh, it means so much to me. Gosh, I say to Duncan, I'll be myself the harbinger and make joyful the hearing of my wife with your approach. And I'm a queer woman, and I've never got to say a line like that in Shakespearean English or in contemporary English. And I've worked with plenty of queer artists and sought out opportunities to have my queerness as part of my character. But to actually sort of say to a world of thanes, I'm going home to tell my wife that you're approaching, and have those characters respond with, yeah, cool, all right. You know, honestly, I love saying that every night. It means so much to me. Then we have this more complex, more jagged-edged idea of two women challenging one another about masculinity, which I completely buy, because I feel like living inside a patriarchy, I've absorbed some of those ideas and some of that language. The idea of manning up is not, you know, using that phrase is not too far away from language that I use. And but we get to the end of the play where the poor player comes in the section where Macbeth talks to the audience about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, and this beautiful idea of being life being but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets their hour upon the stage. Well, we had a big discussion about that in the rehearsal room. Because the pronoun that is used is his hour. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And I tweaked it to their hour. And we talked a lot about it as actors. Some people felt that it was a special speech that we shouldn't really mess with. And I feel that his is not a gender-neutral pronoun. So if it's an object or a metaphor or a person or a concept, his overlays a level of gender which excludes. And I felt like putting there in would include everybody in the audience. And that's what I believe that section of language is about. I'm trying to avoid the word speech. That section of text is about us all looking at ourselves on that stage, or imagining our lives as being on a stage. And for me to use the word there, I hope includes everybody. And I hope it, therefore, is the sort of the final little jewel in the journey from his, her world through to there. And I'm hoping that takes us into a place with Shakespeare that means we can get rid of some of this binary language and and with that, yeah, bring more people in as performers and audience members.
That idea of manning up and this, the kind of the internalized misogyny that that many, most women feel in our society, and therefore this kind of aspiration towards masculine characteristics, especially for women in positions of power. All of that sort of made me think a lot about Grounded. I don't want to conflate those two roles, because I think there are also lots of differences between them, but were you thinking about that role, and could you trace a line between that role and Macbeth?
Yeah, I really could, and I guess this is the sort of privilege of staring so closely at two particular roles for this amount of time. I mean, it was a huge part of my life, Grounded. Interestingly, I mean, just for some context, really, the play Grounded, you know, was a US fighter pilot who's become a drone pilot, and a supremely confident warrior that becomes a dissatisfied warrior, and steps into a journey of somebody who becomes subject to post-traumatic stress, which is unique in the world of a drone pilot because of that particular fighter not being in a combat zone themselves, being in the safety of a mobile hut several thousand miles away, staring at a screen. That level of that conversation about remoteness and your proximity to battle exists in Macbeth, in that, you know, you meet the warrior at the supreme height of her capability and her agency at the top of the play. You know, she's won this tremendous battle and is being lauded for it. She is covered in blood. She's had this direct, very gruesome killing, you know, not just killing someone, doing away with them on the battlefield, but from the nave to the chops, you know, this incredibly brutal end that she's delivered MacDonald to. It's you couldn't get a bloodier, more grisly, more hands-on murder described, really. And then as the play progresses, as she becomes more and more frightened and concerned about her own safety, she starts subcontracting these murders out to other people. Lennox is a role that we've developed somewhat for this production and become something of a henchman for her in this show. So you see this level of distance in the way that you have with remote warfare in Grounded, you know, the idea of culpability being further and further away. And I see that in our modern day capitalism, you know, the idea that we had an arms fair in East London recently, and the fact that we as a society are so distanced and removed from the idea of what overhead bombing can be, what occupation is, that we allow this to be conducted in our country, you know, it's mind-boggling to me that we would invite people around for an arms fair. Oh, it's just disgusting what happens in London every 2 years, and we don't contact it because we are too far removed. We're living very comfortably in our lives, thanks very much. So those are two themes that I see as being really familiar. In terms of gender, you know, a woman that takes herself seriously as a warrior, a woman that steps into that military world and chooses not to see it or chooses to absorb some of it, but is primarily focused on being a fighter first and foremost. And it's interesting because I've spoken to a lot of military personnel for both roles, and I'd expressed my concern, particularly for this one, because I knew there was a little bit of stirring about a woman playing the role of Macbeth. And I spoke to a major in the British Army who'd been an advisor on Grounded and helped me with this. And he said, I don't really understand it. You know, he's not a theatre person. He said, there are women serving in elite fighting forces all the way around the world. It only seems to be in the theatre industry that there's a problem with it. And he was completely baffled, you know. And I'm baffled as well. I don't really understand it. But the idea that a woman could be doubted as an elite fighter because of her gender just doesn't belong to the modern army in many cultural contexts. And that's something I've been holding close to really throughout this production, that actually we don't need to justify it. That moment is gone. We need to just tell the story, and hopefully the audience can see interesting things in the world and the relationships.
Of course, another connection between Grounded and Macbeth is that both directed by Chris Hayden, who you've worked with a lot. What is it about that collaboration that you've found particularly productive and rewarding?
Well, I think Chris has been extremely generous as a director, really, in that he's seen some potential for me in a role and encouraged me to take that on in a way that maybe I wouldn't have done if I was left to my own devices. My background is devising and experimental theatre, and I remember many years ago Chris saying, "So when are you going to do a proper play then, you know, in jest?" And you know, gently making a bit of fun of me in terms of the sort of work I was making and saying, "You know, come on, do a play, come and do something with some text." And I was very happy making the devised work, really, but there is, especially as an untrained actor, like I feel like I have to try different things in order to put myself through training of my own making, if you like, or through a journey of learning through directors and through processes. I kind of think that's really what acting is about as well. You never stop really learning. That's, you're meant to be a student really for the rest of your life, I think. But he suggested I come and try out some different things, and I did some auditions for different things. And yeah, we've made a few plays together: Trojan Women, The Christians, Grounded, and this. And his interest in making sure that there are central female characters and that they're the centre of the story has been something I've really appreciated in his output of work, particularly at the Gate. And it's been an opportunity for me to stretch and learn and do things that I wasn't sure I could do. I'd done some solo shows before Grounded, but I hadn't performed. Yeah, to go to the Travers Edinburgh Festival was a completely different kettle of fish from performing in a in a smaller fringe venue or in a context where we might not get a huge audience, but it would be very appreciative and. Yeah, that suddenly felt very exposing, but it was a terrific script. And I do remember reading that play, him sending it to me and me going, okay. And I made myself a big cup of tea and I started reading through the play. And wow, you know, this incredibly strong female character, and I was expecting to get to a point where she would unravel. There would be some kind of section or monologue about feeling sad about her boyfriend or her dad or something. And there's always some moment where a woman has to sort of undo herself a little bit in front of an audience, and it never came. I just read through all 54 pages and it never happened. The character unraveled somewhat, but that was because of plot. That was the point of the story, the overarching theme of the play, not because she had to express some kind of frailty or vulnerability. It was exhilarating to read. And I think in a way, Macbeth seemed to Chris anyway like an obvious next step for that archetype, because almost as if, you know, frozen in time inside that box, you know, we had this box as a set for Grounded, that you could just, you know, go to blackout and open up and the first line would be, "So foul and fair a day I have not seen," and then Macbeth would start. And it took a while for him to convince me that was true, but I'm glad he did. There's a lot of Macbeths produced, and I wanted to understand more about why there should be another one made, really. I feel you have to ask that question, why are we making it? And particularly if your work is supported by public money, I think you have to sort of really interrogate your motivations for making a piece of work. We felt at the time when we were talking about it that, you know, how does this relate to the outside world? And of course, we thought that Hillary Clinton was going to become president of the United States, and that the most direct relevance would be that you have a female commander-in-chief. And I think our concerns were, would people greet a female Macbeth with open arms? Hillary Clinton will be, you know, boss of the world at that point, so there will be some context that will make that step easier for audiences. And in fact, it's been a complete flip what's happened, in that I think audiences are more than ready for it. They are fully embracing casting which is I'm not going to use the word gender flip, actually. I'm going to use the word open to genders. They're ready for that. They've been ready for a long time. So theatres, directors and casting directors just need to provide those opportunities, I think, for that kind of storytelling. The audiences are totally up for it. But what we didn't think we'd be dealing with was a White House that is so full of equivocation. The post-truth, I don't know how I feel about that phrase either, post-truth, really. It's a bit jargony, but the idea of openly lying to a world media, to a world population, and that being an entirely normalised experience. I don't think we were even ready to believe that was possible, and that would be the background for our Macbeth. Not that I was naive about how world politics works and how the White House works or Westminster, but the acuteness of what we're seeing at the moment in terms of lying like truth is something that's still very shocking, and we must make sure that we don't normalise at all. I say false thanes during the one of the later sections of text, and I can't believe, you know, that these words are... The idea that somebody can tumble into this narcissistic, desperate, vengeful place and seek to undermine everyone else and punish everyone else. I can't believe, I'm still shocked that we're dealing with something so very real in our own world.
Mm. What role do you think theatre has in this current political reality?
Lots of thoughts really about that. I think when we do it right, we can create work that has enough complexity in it that it doesn't necessarily solve a fixed question that you've decided to ask. So from an artist's point of view, this is the question, this is the answer, aren't we clever? We've made it nice for an audience, they can come and watch it. Like that level of, that idea that you would do all that work on behalf of an audience is really obnoxious, I think, really. And I think when theatre gets it right, it's when you set up a series of complicated questions and you're willing, in the making of the work and in the live moment of sharing that work with an audience, to have your own notions of what you believe to be challenged as well as makers. The complexity of multiple viewpoints that aren't necessarily your own, areas in which you feel uncomfortable, ways in which you're prepared to be challenged. I mean, I'm a white cis woman in the role of Macbeth, and I'm really chuffed that there's a female Macbeth, but honestly, when there's a black trans woman playing the role, then I'll be popping the champagne, because that's progress. Or somebody who's deaf, or somebody who uses a wheelchair in their life. You know, the idea of putting work in front of people that's all sorted with a bow, you know, tied in a bow, is not something I enjoy, but something that is struggling and living and trying to figure itself out and needs an audience of people in order to get closer to some kind of clarity. That's the theatre that I find exciting.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website at theatrevoice.com for hundreds of interviews with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was presented by Catherine Love and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria Rinaldo Museum in London. Thanks for listening.